Now it's written, Ve'elu Boneha, and these are her children. So immediately he comes in with a comment which reminds us of something that we say all the time. It says, Al Tikre Boneha, Ela Boneha. Don't say that it means her children, but take it in the sense that those who built her up. Of course, I mean, it doesn't mean that they weren't her children. What it means is that besides being children, they are also the ones who give sustenance to her, to help her become important, so they build her up. Okay, that's the idea. Of course, as I said, it reminds us, first of all, the comment, you know, the end of the last paragraph in the Gemara Brachas, and it's also found in a couple of other places in the Talmud. We say it, you know, right, that the scholars, the Talmidei Chachamim, they increase peace in this world. As the Pasuk says in the book of Isaiah, all your children will be learned in God, right? And great will be the peace of your children. It says over there, what? In other words, the idea being that your children are the builders of the future. Right, okay, so here they were the ones who built her, okay? Boneha, says Rashi, fifth line over there, says, okay? Mm-hmm. Says, Elu Shemos Baalov, right? These are the names of her husband, Shebenoa Vaso Mebuna, Kishar Noshim, who made her understood, literally, Mevuno, you could say that he made her famous as other women, Benisuim, by marrying her, right? Uvonim, and by having children with her. And then, who are the names of the children? So we said those three names, right? One is Yeshur, another one is Shovav, right? And the third one is Ardon. I know, Ardon sounds almost like a long metal number. Okay, so now we go to the names of the kids, right? Okay, so we said her children are called Yesher, right? So why is the first one called Yesher? He says, She Yesher is Atzmo. He straightened himself out, literally. Rashi. She Yesher is Atzmo, because we're referring to the father, who was he? Kole, right? Mm-hmm. And what happened? He straightened himself out, militos estos hamragun, that he should not make the same mistake as the spies made. Okay? Shovav. Why was the next child called Shovav? So again, Sheshivev, right, es Yitzro. Sheshivev es Yitzro. Literally, he conquered his evil inclination, right? The Yetzer over here is like the Yetzirah. So Rashi changed the right. Sheshiva was Atzmei, in other words, he conquered himself in what way? Me'atzosan, from their evil counsel, right? And he says, how did he get the name like Sheva? So he says, Loshon Habas HaShoveva. The language of the word Shovav is as we find in a pasuk in Yirmiyahu, where he refers to the people of Israel as being Habas HaShoveva, in other words, the wayward daughter. So Shovav originally means wayward, but at the same time, remember that this is also related to what word? It's related to the word Shuv. Right, to return. And of course, Shuv gives us the noun Teshuvah. You understand? Repentance, turning aside from evil and doing that which is good. So therefore, the implication is over here that then that Kolev called the next son Shovav in order to indicate the fact that he had turned aside from the evil counsel, that is from his, let's say, the desire to do evil by joining in with the other Meraglim, right? And instead, he did Shuvah, okay? Of course, Rashi continues by saying Abbas HaShogu, he says Yotzanis Moredes, right? Meaning a daughter who goes out even though the parents say is supposed to be home at this time. That's a Yotanis. Okay, Umoredis, and of course that means then rebellious. Okay, the Achinami says Rashi, and likewise, therefore, Korine Merid, the Kurachmina, calls her Merid in another pasuk Al Shem Shem Morad Ba'atzas Beragin, in order to indicate the fact that he rebelled against the advice, the evil plan, the evil advice of the spies. Okay, all right. Now, who is the third one? Okay, Lomazen. Yeah. Okay, okay. And how about Ardon? Who is Ardon? You know, he named this child Ardon. So it says, Sherodo es Yitzro. He subdued his evil nature. Ardon, from the word Rodo. Okay, Rashi again, as he explains, Sherodo be Yitzro, right? Shehoya mesiso litosim ohen. And the Yitzhahora, he said, was telling him, go, wanted to join the majority, say what they want, right? Be a popular man and so on. And instead, you know, he subdued his Yetzer Hara, and he did the you know, that which was right, but at the same time it made him very unpopular, needless to say, because if you remember, what did the people want to do with you know, Moshe, Aaron and Kolev and so on, right? They wanted to stone them, if you remember. So obviously he didn't gain any popularity at that particular time. But of course, in the Beit Shalalim's eyes, there's already a different popularity coming. Mm-hmm. He did that which was right by refraining from evil and being able to conquer the desire to do evil. in last week's Sedra, there's an interesting pasuk over there. Pasuk says, "We abdi kolev." My servant, as for my servant Kalev, right? Ekev hoysa ruach acheres imo, right? Inasmuch as, you know, he had a different spirit, right? Vayamale acheroi, and he followed me. In other words, he did that. So the Rebbeinu Shalom says, therefore I will bring him into the land, you know, which was sworn to our fathers. Okay? All right. So, the wording is very unusual. Why does it say ruach acheres imo, that he had a different spirit within him? So if you take a look at Rashi and other commentators over there, you'll see that they interpret it in the sense that in reality his first idea, his first instinct actually was to side with the other ten, you know, right? But because of the fact that, you know, he got up and he got a ruach acheres, a different idea altogether, and he decided to do that which was right in his own eyes, namely, you know, to bring back the encouraging report that even though Eretz Yisrael would be difficult to conquer, but if they had faith in God, they should not lose faith, but they should go ahead and follow, you know, and so that therefore, this is how they interpret ruach acheres. So as we see over here from the Gemara, they stress again and again the fact, I mean, why did he call his children, you know, by these names like Shovav, Ardon and so on. So the answer is because he was able to conquer his Yetzer Hara and you know, remove himself from the plans of the council of the spies who did evil.
Actually,
yes.
The spies went in, actually almost gave two reports. The first gave a general report.
Correct.
But then they went all through the camp,
right,
and gave to each section a much harsher, much not only report, right, but actually counsel. First was report. Then they told the people, you can't do it.
Yeah, I remember actually. The first report, I mean, the first thing they said, you know, it's a good land. They didn't say it was a bad land to begin with. They said it's a good land,
but,
and look at the fruit that we brought back and so on. But then came the but, that the people, the giants, were grasshoppers, and so we can never do it. Not only that, but they said, it's a land which eats up, literally, the people who live over there. And, you know, as our Chazal explained, because when the spies came, they saw a lot of funerals going on over there, so they figured that nobody could live. It's a horrible land to live in. Everybody's died, all the funerals.
But what they didn't know is that the Rebbeinu Shel Olam did it for various reasons. First of all, so that the spies wouldn't be noticed, because people would be busy taking care of the Levites, right? And secondly, it says because the Canaanites had heard that the people of Israel were coming, and so they took all the matmonios. In other words, they took all their treasures and they hid them in the house, in their homes, okay, so that the Jews would not be able to find them, okay. But what happened was that when they came to the land and they found that it was, that there was saras, that leprosy broke out in the houses, so naturally they had to
destroy them and they found them. That's all something else. I mean, the people there that looked up at them, they felt that they were nothing.
Right.
Nobody told them that.
Right,
they were nothing.
Of course.
That inferiority comes.
Exactly. No question about that. Yeah. No, listen, there were many times that the Mashiach should have come, and unfortunately, he missed the timetable. What am I going to say? It's a famous story in Gemara elsewhere, which speaks about the fact that it was Rabbi Yeshua, somebody who came to Rome, and they told him that the Mashiach is there at the gates of the city of Rome. He's a beggar and so on, dressed in poor clothes and so on. So he found Mashiach and says, so when are you coming? So he says, Hayom, today. But he didn't come. So he went back and he said, how come? He said, Hayom. So he says, yeah, but you don't know the rest of the pasuk. The rest of the pasuk says, we say that, Lechunu Rananu, there's Psalm 95 over there. And it says, Hayom in Bekolos Ishmo. Today, the Mashiach would come if we would only listen to God's voice. But obviously, if we don't, so this is why Mashiach is taking his time and he's not here yet. So, another time, the Gemara says that the Chizkiyahu, King Hezekiah, was supposed to lead Mashiach and so on. Because in his days, everybody, young and old, they studied Torah, they were expert, even in the most difficult kinds of halachas, the most difficult dinim, they were all expert. From children right through the oldest people and so on. But again, the Mashiach did not come. So, the coming of the Mashiach is something that we hope for, we pray for, but we don't know who, what, when, or where. This is something sabbatical. It's an article of faith, that's all.
We can't push it.
No, we can't. Right. Because, this is what we call deichikas hakeitz, you try to put pressure and bring the coming of the Mashiach, literally the end of the world as we know it, to bring it about right now. And we're warned that we should not be that way, not supposed to. We're supposed to live life normally, live a life of Torah and mitzvahs and everything else, and leave the coming of the Mashiach to the Rebbeinu Shel Olam. Not that we should try to bring the Mashiach. Alright. Haklal. Alright. So, Ardon. Alright. So we saw one meaning of the word Ardon is Sherodah is Yitzhak, right? That he had dominion over his evil inclination. The Iko de Amre, but there are those who say that the name Ardon is Al Shehoyu Poneho Domim Leveret. It's because Miriam's complexion became like a rose. In other words, once she got married and she had children and so on, so then her complexion blossomed like that of a rose. Okay? Alright. Then Pasuk continues, La Ashur Avitakoa Hoyushte Noshim Chelo Venara. So, literal translation, Ashur, the father of Tekoa, had two wives. One of them is called Chelo, and the other one is called Nara, right? So, first of all, Gemara says, Ashur, Zeh Kalev. Who is Ashur? It's another name for Kalev. The Lomo Nikro Shmoi Ashur, so why then do they refer to him as Ashur? So the answer is, Shehush Charu Pono Beta Nios. Okay? That his face literally became schwarz, became darkened
from all the fasting. He fasted in order that the, you know, the that he should have the right counsel to give to the people of Israel, and that you know, the counsel of the wicked spies should not succeed. So he fasted for that reason, and that's why his face, you know, became dark. Okay. All right. Now, Shehushchu Ponov, right, says Rashi, Shekibel Olov Tanius Harbe, right, Sheyinotzel, in other words, accepted, the, he took upon himself many fasts, Sheyinotzel, so that he might be saved, may Atzas Mivarakon, from the advice, from the counsel of the spies. Okay. All right, now the next word in the Pasuk over there, well, take a look, three words, right, Ula Ashkar Avi Tokoa, right? All right, so now they take the word Avi. What about Avi? So it says, Avi shenasa lo ke'ev. It's because when Kalev married Miriam, so he became like a father to her. Not just like a husband, but like a father to her. Tekoa. Why Tekoa? So he says, Shetaka is libo le'ovishu b'shmayim. Tekoa is from the word toka, which means to put in something, or to hold fast, or something like that. Of course, it also means to blow shofar. I mean, there are different meanings for it, okay? But, you know, letkoa normally means, like, to put something in firmly, okay? Okay, so, in other words, he clung closely to the Rebbeinu Shalom. Shetokas Ligoy, right? Shanasaloka of, right? I'm doing the Rashi line by line as we do it, all right? Shanasaloka of, right? The Hisasek Bor, in other words, he became like a father unto her in order to take care of her, right? The Refuos, with the medications that she needed in order to get better. Umizonos, and also the various foods, Hatzrichim Nechoyla, that, you know, a sick person needs. So therefore, he was like a father who is gentle and taking care of all her needs in order that she should get better, right? And then, what is this? Tekoa, he says, Shetokas libo le'yovish b'shamayim, shelo liyotz batzas b'ragam. In other words, he was firm in his faith with God, not to follow the evil counsel of the spies, okay? All right. Now, then the father says, what? Hoyush Teidosif, right? That he had two women.
Two wives.
So they say, what do you mean he had two wives? He didn't have two wives. It's Miriam. But it was a before Miriam and an after Miriam, as we'll say. Okay? Well,
No.
I'm saying before she was sick and now she's, you know, she's better. Okay? So he says, now some Miriam, he says, Kishtei Noshim. Miriam became like two women. Chela Benara. Okay? So what do you mean, Chela Benara, where it says, you know, that he had two wives, Chela and Nara? So he says, Lo Chela Benara Havai. They weren't Chela Benara. Elo Bitchila. At first she was Chela. Chela is from the word Chole, right? Okay. She was sickly. But if so, but finally, Nara, she became rejuvenated. She became like a young girl again. Now we'll take a look at Rashi and see what he has to say over here. Okay? Chela, so he says, you know, Chela reminds us of what word? Choli. By the way, you should all be getting to be expert readers of Rashi by now. It could be in various places, because some Rashi comments are big and others are small. Okay.
And we have the small.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So, first she was Chela. In other words, as we said before, she was sick, right? Well, if so, Nara. And then she became Nara. In other words, she is Rapa or Becholya, right? She became healed from her illness. Bechozra, Betoar Ponim Kinara. And her complexion, her face, once more, returned to being that of a young girl. Okay? All right. Uvenei Chela, and then it says, and who were the children of Chela? So the answer is Tzoras, the Tzohar, the Esnon.
All these are very, very strange names, needless to say, right? All right, so naturally, if they're strange, then they deserve an interpretation. Okay, Soros, why was this boy or girl, whatever it was, why was she called Soros? It's supposed to be boys, I guess, I don't know. At any rate, why was it called Soros? Shana says, Sora, l'chavra seha. This means that Miriam became a Tzora to her companions. All right, now I have to explain, what does the word Tzora mean? Naturally, if I would say to you, a Tzora, what's your first...
Trouble.
Trouble, right, correct. But you know that the word Tzora also has a different translation. Anybody know what the other translation would be?
Yeah.
Huh? No. Huh? Yeah, you're on the right track, correct.
Rona.
Loud. You fought.
A second wife,
okay. So you remember the first chapter of the book of Samuel, right? We have the story about who?
Hannah
and Peninnah, correct? All right. And how is Peninnah referred to over there? He has nothing so rossa. In other words, that the other wife, literally the rival wife, okay, this is what Sora means over here. So the rival wife, right, made Hannah's life miserable, right? Because, you know, she would always taunt her, look at all the kids that I have and you haven't even been in birth money. Right.
Yeah.
Yes. But as you see, the word Sora over here can be interpreted then. In other words, she became like a rival to the other women. As Rashi says, take a look. Okay? All right, first of all, Bnei Chila, says Rashi over there. You see that? In other words, what about the descendants of Chilization? Nivnes was rapes, right? That she was built and she was cured. So mishubochim hoyu, right? And she was so that these are praiseworthy adjectives to refer to her. Lios soras v'tzohaviyesta. Sora, he says, the chavur seho. Niskamis biopia. She became so beautiful that other women were jealous of her beauty. Okay, so that was Soros. All right, now we come to the next name. Okay, Zohar is related to the word Zohar. In other words, it means radiance, light. Does anybody remember where the word Zohar occurs in Chumash Bereishis?
Noach.
Right, story about Noach, right? It says Zohar tas elateva. Right? You are to make. Yeah, right, in the ark, right. Some say it's a window, others say it was a precious stone that gave light, and so on, right? And of course, in the word Zohar, we also have the word Zoharayim.
Midday,
noonday. It's Zoharayim, because that's when the sun is at its brightest, and so that's the reason why. All right. So, Zohar. Shehoyu ponehu domen Zoharayim. In other words, her face was as bright as noontime. Okay, and Esnon, which in the Torah doesn't have a good Esnon means literally a gift. Okay, in the Torah we are told that you're not to bring an Esnon Zono to Beis Hashem, right? In other words, the gift given to a prostitute,
well, she shouldn't bring it
and dedicate it to the shul.
Is it a gift or right. is it the reward?
Consider it as a reward if you wish. Right.
Yeah.
But the point is, I mean, obviously it's related to the word Gosein, Matono, and so on and so forth. You see the idea. Right. And then if you take, for example, the first chapter or the second chapter of the book of Hosea, where he speaks about the Soros with the wife, if you remember. She said, Esnon, Hey Molly, and so on, Shanoslum Ahavai, these are the rewards, these are the gifts that my lovers have given unto me, and so on. Of course, at that time, Hosea is talking against the Avodah Zorah about the fact that his wife, who really symbolizes the Jewish people, have gone astray and have worshipping the Baal and the Astoreth and so on and so forth, right? So we see that the word Isnan there does not have a very nice meaning. But here, as we'll see, they give it a nicer interpretation, okay? What is the interpretation of Isnan? So he says, Shekol Horeh Oso Molech Isnan Li'ishto. He says, whoever looked at the beauty of Miriam immediately would go and bring home gifts to his wife so that he could go to bed with her. Rashi, Molech Esnan Li'ishto, he says, Shehoyo Mis'ave L'mishkav Noshim. In other words, he would get a Yetzahara, and, you know, he wants to, you know, the average person, he would look, he would get the inspiration. You know.
Inspired.
Yeah, he'd become inspired, you know, that he would go home and want to be close with his wife, okay? All right, so that's one interpretation, the way Esnan is perceived, okay? Now I guess that's it. Lo and behold, now we finally come back again to what we started with a week and 2 weeks ago and so on and so forth, namely, to take the first chapter in the book of Shmos and continue with the story of how Pharaoh enslaved the people of Israel, right? And since we've already spoken about the Mialdos, the Hebrew midwives, so now the Gemara continues now with a further discussion on the midwives. Okay? Since we identified them either with Miriam and Yocheved or with Yocheved and Elisheva, right? So now we get back to it. It's written by Itzav Paro L'chol Amo. It's written that Pharaoh commanded his entire people. So, Omar Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Chanina said, you know what the pasuk means. He says, Af alamo gozar. He says, it's written by Tzav Paro L'chol Amo to his entire people. In other words, he made a decree that any baby born, whether a Jew or an Egyptian, should be killed by the midwives. The Yomar Rabbi Yosef Bar Chanina, and he continues with another interpretation, and he says, Shalosh Gezeros Gozar. Alright? Pharaoh actually issued a series of three different decrees. But Chilo, the first decree was what? In Bein Hu Vahamiten or so. That if it's a boy, kill him. Right. So obviously, this didn't help very much. So therefore, he came up with another decree. What was the next decree? Philip Sof. Okay. Which, if you'll take a look on the margin, because the word lesof doesn't really fit in over here, look on the left, and you see tzorich liyos v'achakach. Right? This is the correct reading over here. Okay? And he says, you know, this is the way we find it in the Yalkut. Yalkut is the Yalkut Shimoni, and also in the Yaakov. It's another great, famous compilation, you know. So, there the reading is v'achakach. Okay? So, and afterwards, what was the second decree? Kol habein hayelod hayorot hashlichu. Okay, he saw that the midwives weren't doing their job, so now he issued a new decree, and what was it? Any boy to be born, throw him into the river. Okay? Belif sof, and finally, afalamo gozar. He even made a decree against the Egyptians as well. Now, why did he do that? So this is what we have to see in Rashi. Okay? Afalamo gozar, you see that in the Rashi over there? Okay, so Dorash Rabbi Tanchuma. So here Rashi quotes the Medrash of Rabbi Tanchuma. Okay, and he says, Yom Shenoilad Moshe, the day that Moses was born, Omru Itztagni Noav. So the stargazers of Pharaoh said, Hayom Nolad Moshion Shal Yisrael. Today, the Redeemer, literally the Savior, right? But the Redeemer of Israel has been born. V'yein onu yodim, and we don't know, however, im Mitzri hu o Yehudi. We don't know whether he is an Egyptian or is he a Jew. So what happened? The Yomad, so he arose, v'kibetz kolam. He gathered all his people together. U'vikesh mehem, and he asked them, as he asked everybody, Litain lo hanolodim bo bayom, right, to give him any boy who was born on that very day, the gozar of al amo, okay, and he made the same decree apply even to his own people, because as the astrologer said to him, you know, we don't know whether he will be a Jew or whether he will be an Egyptian, so therefore he wasn't taking any chances. He wanted to kill off any boy born that day, whether Jew or Egyptian. Okay? We'll learn a couple of more minutes and we'll call it a night. Okay? All right. Then it's written.
Going back to the text?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, going back to the text. All right. Vayelech Ish Bebeis Levi. It's written over there that a man, this is the beginning of the second chapter in the book of Shmos, if you remember, right?
Mm-hmm.
He says that a man of the house of Levi went. It's a funny word. He went. So the Gemara wants to know, Leichen Holach, where'd he go? So Rav Yehuda bar Zvina, Rav Yehuda, the son of Zvina, said, Sheholach batzatz bito. He went in accordance with the advice of his daughter. In other words, Miriam gave him advice, and he went and followed what she had told him. Tana, we have a tradition. It says Amram Godol Hador Hoya, right? Amram was the most important person in his generation. Okay? Kevon Sheomar Paro, or Shegozar Paro, as it says on the column in the margin over there. Kevon Shegozar Paro, inasmuch as, you know, when it happened that Pharaoh made a decree, Paro HaRasha, right, the wicked Pharaoh, that what? Kol HaBein HaYelod HaYerot HaShnichucho, right, that any son, any boy to be born is to be thrown into the river. So Omar, so he said, LaShav HaLamelin, we are working for nothing. In other words, there's no purpose in our working. No purpose even in our living. This is really what he's trying to say. There's no purpose even in our living. Omar the Gerashes Ishta. So he arose and he divorced his wife. In other words, why should we bring children into the world when children are going to be thrown into the river and killed? Right? This was his reasoning. So if he divorced his wife, so Omdu Kulam Gerashes Ishta. So everybody, all the Jews then, divorced their wives. Omar lo Bito. So his daughter said to him, Abba. You know, your decree is even worse than Pharaoh's. It's more difficult, literally, but it's worse. Why? Pharaoh's decree is only directed against males. But your decree will serve to destroy the future of both males and females, right? Power lo gozar ela b'ilam hazeh. Pharaoh's decree only applies to this world, right? But your decree will be effective in this world and in the world to come, because if we don't have Jewish children born, so are we going to have the Jewish children who eventually will wind up in Elam Haba? So that you're destroying both worlds for them. Paro Harasha, wicked Pharaoh, Zofek Miskayemis Gezeroso, maybe and maybe not, his gezeira, in other words, his decree, will be effective, right? Sofek, yeah, sofek miskayemis gezeira, say, right? And sofek eno miskayemis, right? It may or may not be fulfilled. But ato, tzaddik, you are a righteous person. So bevadai, certainty, she gezeirotcho miskayemis, if you issue a decree, then that decree is going to be fulfilled. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says in the book of Job, it says about Tigzor Omer Vayokim Lo. You made a decree with your words, and it's effective. So in that case, Omar Behzir Sishto. So he rose and he remarried his wife. Okay? Omdu Kulom Behzir Sishosehim. So all the other Jews then remarried their wives. Okay? Then it's written by Yikach by Yachzor. It's written in the singular. He took, right? And says by Yachzor. It says by Yikach. Okay, no. This is a different problem. Okay. It's written by Yikach, which would mean literally he married, right? All right. So he says by Yachzor or by Yachzir, something like that. It should really say that, you know, he restored, he returned, you know, he remarried her. Why does it say he married? Okay. In other words, the language is not that clear. This is what they're questioning. So Amar Rabbi Yehuda bar Zvino says, "Sha'osalo maaseh lekuchin." He says the reason being that he didn't simply, let's say, go to the justice of the peace and marry her again, but he made a wedding for her, just like the very first wedding, with all, you know, going to Sheikh Joseph and having all the everything that's important, right? In other words, he says Hoshiva by Pirion, he had her sit in a, the Jung's translation of Pirion over here is palanquin. I'm sure we've all seen palanquins. It's like a chair that they could carry people on, right? So in other words, the bride would be carried in on a special seat, you know, carried by people. Okay, I don't know if that gives birth to the fact that they raised the Chos and Gala these days on chairs or not, but anyway, this is the original idea of Pirion, right? And not only that, but the Aaron and Miriam Miraculum for Neho, Aaron and Miriam were dancing before her. This is how happy they were that their father and mother had become reunited, right? And the ministering angels, Omru, they said, Eim Habonim Semecha. She is a happy mother of children. Okay, I think we'll stop at this particular point. And then, Yotasha, we shall continue next Wednesday.
Where are we?
Yeah, we are still on Yud Beis Omid Aleph. Okay, a little past the middle point on the page. Okay,
it's July 9th, 1997.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now the Gemara continues with the exposition of the story about Miriam and Amram and Moshe Rabbeinu and so on. Okay. And of course it started off, if you remember, based upon what we had the previous week, where we said that it was on the merit of the pious women that the people of Israel were redeemed in Egypt, right. And obviously Miriam had a very important role to play in the Geula, in the redemption of the people of Israel from Egypt. We also, I had mentioned her previously connection with the idea of, you know, the idea of Mida Keneged Mida, which was a major theme of the last Mishnah that we had, and that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam gives reward or punishment, you know, depending upon how the person acts,
the
person, right? And in her particular case, we have learned that the people of Israel waited for 7 days after she was put into Cherem, so to speak, because of the fact that she had slandered Moshe Rabbeinu when she talked against her, okay? And this was a reward to her for the fact that when Moshe Rabbeinu was put in his little basket,
she watched him
on the banks of the river over there, right among the bulrushes, so she waited, she stayed around in order to watch and see what would happen. So that it all ties in together. All right, and so the Gemara now continues with the next few words in the passage in the Torah. It says, "Es bas Levi." If you remember, it's written that "Vayelech ish ben beis Levi," that a man literally went from the house of Levi. "Vayekach yishoas bas Levi," and he took as a wife the daughter of Levi. Okay, now. Pshat, of course, we could say that what Pshat is that he married a woman who was of the same tribe that he was. But as we already know over here, we're not concentrating on Pshat, but we're concentrating on Drash. And so we have some very interesting Drashas over here at this particular point. And again, as I said, Rashi made tremendous use of this in his commentaries to the Chumash. in connection with these passages. Okay. So, the part of the pasuk says, right, that he married the daughter of Levi. So this, the Gemara immediately questions and says, Efshar? Does everybody have a place?
No.
It is just below the middle. Okay.
No,
you see, it says Tilim, a little note, Tilim Tilfiyut Gimel. Go down one line. You see the word, it's the same line as it says, Ezbas
Levi.
Yes, all right?
Yes,
this
yes.
is where we are right now. Ezbas
okay.
Levi. All right. So, now literally, Ezbas Levi means that he married who? The daughter of Levi.
Yeah.
So that's why the Gemara asks the following question. It says, Efshar, is it possible? Right? If that's the case, how old was she? She was 130 years old, right? They call her Lord Bas, and yet what do they call her? They call her a daughter, which would imply, of course, that she was a young girl at the age of 130, right?
She could still be a daughter.
Yeah, yeah, okay. But this is the implication right now, the question, okay? We're talking about Yocheved. Talking about Yocheved, the mother of Moshe and Aaron and Miriam, okay?
How is that Miriam both related to Chur? Is that her Bethany's son?
To who?
Chur.
You mean Chur? Well, according to some, he was a nephew, but according to others, he was her son.
He was her son.
Yes.
Her son.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So this is what the Gemara is asking. It says, 130 years old, still call her a daughter, in other words, in the sense of, you know, a young girl.
Yeah.
So this refers back to a statement made by Rav Kamer Rav Chanino, who said, I'm speaking more in Basra, but it's a well-known statement. He says, Zu Yocheved. He says, this Bas Levi, this refers to whom? This is Yocheved, right? Shehorah saw, but derech, beleido saw, says that she was conceived on the road when Yaakov and his family, you know, moved to Egypt after they left the land of Canaan. So she was conceived by Levi and Mrs. Levi, okay, at that time. The Leidoso, but when was she born? She was born Bein Achomas, which means as they were entering the walls of Egypt, this is when she was born. Okay?
Talking about Yocheved.
Yocheved, right. Shenemar, as the pasuk says, Asher Yoldo Yisol Levi B'Mitzrayim. Right? Because it's written, you know, concerning Yocheved that she was born. That is her mother, right? Bore her unto Levi. Or Yoldo could be taken maybe as a passive. That she was born, although it's not really what the grammar is. The grammar is that she, in other words, her mother, bore her unto Levi in Egypt. So, Leidoso b'Mitzrayim, therefore, he said, this proves that she was born, she was already in Egypt, right? But the Ein Haroso b'Mitzrayim. But she was not conceived in Egypt. She was conceived prior to that particular...
Years don't add up. The years don't add up.
So, for that, we have to take a look at Rashi and see how Rashi understands.
Because
if the
Jews, how long were they in Egypt?
That's a good question. How long were they? Okay.
240 years?
No, according to one interpretation, they were there 210
years. 210
years. Right. There's
so
another
she
one
was
says
born
they were
at
there
the time
230
they
years and so on, yeah. But according to one interpretation, they were there, let's say, for 210 years. Okay? So the question is, how do you count it up? Okay? Because don't forget, we also have, another statement in Bereishis that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam says to Abraham that, you know, Yadoa Teda Ki Yes Arfa Be'asei Lahem, right? You should know with surety, he says, that your seed will be strangers in the land, not their own, right? And the people
years.
Will enslave them, right, and torment them, you know, for 400 years. So the answer is, when do we begin counting the 400, first of all? So, according to one interpretation, the count begins with the birth of Yitzhak. Okay? Or the Bris Ben Absalom. Okay. All right. So it begins at that particular point. But, after all, generations passed, right? There was the generation of Isaac, there was the generation of Jacob, the Jacob and his sons, and so on and so forth. The real enslavement began when? It began after the death of Joseph and his brothers. Okay, that's when the enslavement began. It's written at the beginning of Shmos, right? Vayomas Yosef b'chol echov, b'chol ador ahu, right? That Joseph and his brothers died, and all his generation, right? And then it's written, "V'nei Yisrael poru v'yishvatzu," that the children of Israel, you know, were fruitful, and they multiplied, and they spread throughout the land, right? And at that particular point, this is when the king of Egypt decided at the time to deal with the Jewish question.
Right.
Okay? Right. That's part of it. Yeah. Okay?
Yeah, but therefore, how does it add up then?
All right. So, then we have to figure that about 200 years or so are already taken out from that, or close to 200 years. Okay? Now, the next step is this. According to one interpretation, we find a pasuk in Bereishis that Joseph says to his father and the family, he says, "Redu Shama," right? Go down over there. So Rashi has a tradition at that point that Redu is the course is 200, Dalet is 4, right? Vav is 6, in other words, 210 years. So this is by tradition the amount of years that the people of Israel actually enslaved in Egypt. However, again, there are other ways of counting. Now, let's get back to the Rashi over here.
That's the actual years of enslavement, but that's not the actual years of
sorting, right? What?
Is that the actual number of years that they were down there?
No. Yeah, okay. All right.
Well, the point is...
Yeah, but anyway, they spent 210 years in Egypt, okay?
But if she was born, Yocheved was born when they came down to Egypt,
right?
Or even shortly thereafter, how long were they enslaved?
Okay.
How old was she at the time of Tirzah Mitzrayim?
Well, I don't know. It doesn't say that she survived Yetzias Mitzrayim.
She didn't.
Not Yocheved doesn't mention that.
Okay.
All right.
Because how old was Moshe?
All right. That's already a good question. All right.
Yeah.
It's based upon the fact that we do have a pasuk that how old Aaron was and how old Moshe was when they started in to talk to Pharaoh. Okay.
How old was
Moshe? Was 80 years old already at that point.
Okay.
So Moshe Rabbeinu was 80 years old. We have to figure, that she's older.
Of course.
So this is the reason why it says, that she was Bas Me'er Shloshim. In other words, she must have been 50 years old when she gave birth to Moshe Rabbeinu. Of course, Aaron was 3 years older, and Miriam presumably was the oldest of them, I would say.
Miriam was the oldest.
Probably. It doesn't say it in what order. But it does say that Aaron was 3 years older than Moshe.
Is there different interpretations on the age of Moshe Rabbeinu?
It all depends how you count. But I'm telling you what the pasuk says. Pasuk says that he was 80 years old when he started to speak to Pharaoh. Told Pharaoh, "Send my people." Right?
Right.
Let my people go.
Then
came the 10 plagues. So the question is, how long did it take, for the 10 plagues? So it may have taken a year or something like that. I mean, we don't know exactly. But, they started in. I mean, once the 10 plagues started, it's an ancient way, one after another,
what
they were.
Huh? The
pasuk in the Torah doesn't tell us how long in between each one. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, of course. You find it at the beginning of Shmos. When the Rebbeinu Shalalem tells Moshe to go back to Egypt and talk to Pharaoh, and he was to meet Aaron and so on and so forth, so it's written over there that Moshe was 80 years old. and Aaron was 83 years old when they began talking to Pharaoh. Okay?
We don't know.
We don't know. There's no mention of her leaving Egypt. Okay?
There's no mention of her passing out.
Right. But if we base it, as I say over here, on the basis that she was 130 years old, right? And we know that Moshe Rabbeinu was 80 years old, so presumably she was about 50 years old when she gave birth to Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay? But getting back over here, all right, so the Gemara says, you know, that she was a bas, right? In other words, that she was young again. All right, now let's take a look at the Rashi. Rashi comments upon this idea, okay? Says, bas meo ushloshin. Do you see where it is? On the side, on the right, that you see the base over there, that center of the Basra, okay? Go down a couple of lines, and you see, at the end of the line over there, it says, Bas Meo Shloshim, right?
Yeah, right?
That she was 130 years old. So it says, Kim Nefoy Shri Azil, as the Gemara is going to explain, what? Shenoldo Biri, the son of Mitzrayim, right? She was born as they went down to Egypt. As I said, according to tradition, she was born just as they came within the gates of Egypt, right? At that point she was born. The Israel, right, and the people of Israel, Omdusham Re Shana. Now Re of course means 210, as I told you before.
Right.
You know, the Kaminyon Redu, right? Alright. So the people of Israel were there 110 years. Alright. Umishanoilat Moshe, right? When Moshe was born, Lo Nisakbu probably is what it says. My book it's a little rubbed out over there, so I'm guessing what it is. Elope Shonim, all right? But probably the word is Nisakbu. Maybe you have a clearer text over there. Yeah, okay. They did not wait, they didn't tarry in Egypt only 80 years. Kedesiv, as it is written, Moshe ben Shmonim Shana, no, the passage that I quoted to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Moshe was 80 years old. But Dabra mil Paro, you know, when they, in other words, he and Aaron spoke to Pharaoh, right? Beyosa Shana Yotu. And this is now the point that Rashi is making. It says the whole deal from the time that they began talking to Pharaoh until the time of the Exodus was only 1 year that passed. Mm-hmm. Okay? So that's why I say we don't know exactly how much of a pause there was in between the various plagues. In one plague it says that the plague lasted for 7 days, in the case of another one it lasted 3 days. I mean, that we know. But with the other plagues we don't really have any time indication.
But we know they were all done within a year's time.
Yeah, but within the year's time you had the 10 plagues.
Is the Egyptian history quiet, silent on all that?
Yes.
No record of it at all.
Absolutely. Obviously, they're not happy with what took place, and so they didn't bother to record. They recorded only victories of kings and stuff like that.
Also, the extraordinary of 10 plagues, you know, that would be extraordinary.
Right, right.
But they're silent about it.
They're silent about it, exactly.
Were there other people that were supposed to be shepherds that were kicked out like there?
Yes, that's what they call the Hyksos, right. Well, these theories have been floated around for quite some time. Yeah.
Right. Area capital.
How does history cover the Jews who built the pyramids, for example, as slaves?
Okay. The truth of the matter is, we don't have any definite evidence that the Jews built the pyramids specifically, okay? Don't have that evidence. This is, you know, we have a sort of a tradition, okay?
Other objects.
But certainly, I mean, after all, what does the Torah say? The Torah doesn't say that they built pyramids. It says that they built Ore Miskenos. In other words, they built these store cities for Pharaoh, okay? And of course, remember, we had a few weeks ago, we learned in the Gemara that Pharaoh had them built, and then the place either was torn down again, or it fell down. Remember, it collapsed, remember? And so they did it over again. So, in other words, it was busy work, so to speak, in order to make them toil and toil and toil, and then after they'd accomplished something, bingo.
Yeah.
The whole thing fell apart and they had to start all over again. So that they didn't even have the joy of completion of the work because it was never completed. And this was part of the torture, you know, the torment. You know, if you work hard but you accomplish something, and you can see the accomplishment, so you feel rewarded for all the effort that you put in.
But if you build it, it collapses.
Right.
Also, the point that they saw then, there was no end to their labor or their hard labor.
Right, right.
The end was not nor in sight.
Okay. Yeah. But, as, you know, the popular image is that the Jews built the pyramids. But really, we don't have evidence that it was the Jews who did it, okay? The Egyptians had plenty of slave laborers, you see. They had plenty. Obviously, they needed an army. All you have to do is to watch Cecil B. DeMille, you know. Mm-hmm. Modern interpretation of the C.S. Mitzrayim.
Yeah. Charlton Heston.
Right, right.
That's what it was.
Yeah. Okay. So, as we see from Rashi, then that very same year, right, is the year that the people of Israel left. So Nimtzah, so we find then, he says, She'ovru miridosam achenurlat Moshe kuf lamed shana. So as a result, we find that the calculations show that from the time that the people of Israel first came to Egypt, in the days of Joseph, right, till the point where Moshe Rabbeinu was born, it was 130 years. Because remember, 130 plus the 80 years of Moshe, right? So yeah. That leaves us already, this brings up the figure to 210, okay? Uvshehechzir Amram es Yocheved, right? And now Rashi has the following, that when Amram remarried Yocheved, right? Hoyesomu uberes Moshe. So she was already pregnant with Moshe. So in other words, you know, we don't know how long the divorce lasted, but it couldn't have lasted too long because, you know, Miriam protested, if you remember, and she said that your gezeira, your decree that, you know, men and women should divorce each other and not live and produce children anymore, she said that it was worse than Pharaoh's decree because Pharaoh only decreed against the Zachorim, against the males, and you would deny life to male and female, life in this world, life in the world to come, and so on. So it says, miyad, right? So the Gemara says, immediately, when Amram heard these words, so he remarried her, and as we saw, you know, as we read last week, it was with a wedding ceremony that was just like the very first one for pomp and circumstance and happiness, right? So, she was already pregnant at the time when she was divorced.
So then Amram was not his father?
No, Amram was his father.
Oh yeah, okay.
Yeah.
From the first marriage.
Yeah. First and second marriage. Okay. No, but the point is, right,
the same people.
That she was already pregnant with Moshe at the time when the remarriage
happened. Okay. I see. Yeah.
Okay. So obviously, the time, you know, divorce could not have been too long.
Mm-hmm.
Because she had already become pregnant at that time. Okay? Kedamim, the Kamishman, as we'll learn a little bit further on in the Gemara over here, and then it says, Dama Rabbi Choma, who said, as Rabbi Choma said, the Yesh Nochen, and Yesh Nochen is a chapter in Baba Basra, he said, Zu Yocheved, this is Yocheved. He says, Bifratan, Shad Yodei Mitzrayim, says, if you take a tally, you know, where the Torah enumerates exactly who left Egypt, who left Eretz Canaan in order to come down to Egypt, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you find, Atom Motzei says, Shivim Choser Achas, that it totals 70 minus 1. In other words, there are only 69 people who are mentioned, including even Joseph and his sons, okay? There are only 69 people mentioned. Well, Bichlolom, and, you know, when they're added together, Atol Be'er, Pasuk says, right, Haboa Mitzrayim, or Shivim, right? That those who came to Egypt were 70 of them. So how do you reconcile 69 with 70? So the answer is Zu Yocheved. This is Yocheved. She Yishlimo Minyonon. She filled up the count. In other words, she completed the count, right? B'chnisa Sano here, when they entered the city, you know, where they were settling in Egypt. Okay. All right. So getting back to the Gemara right now. Omar Rabbi Yehuda, he has a different interpretation. Okay. Well, let's put it this way. He wants to prove, again, the idea that Yocheved was, like, she became like a young bride again. Okay? And this is what he's saying. He says, Shenol dubo simoni narz. Right? Says that the word, you know, the term bas that I mentioned before, more than just daughter, but it's to indicate that those things that we associate with a young woman reappeared in Yocheved. Again, what are these things? So Rashi gives a listing of it. All right, that's the next comment over there. It says Simoni Narus. You see it?
Yeah.
Okay. It says Simoni Narus. In other words, you know, tokens of the fact, you know, that she was now like a young girl again. First of all, it says Chozwa Limei Alumeho. She returned to the days of her youth, the Orach Kenoshim, which is the Torah's expression for the fact that she had periods again. Okay?
That's right.
Uvesoar ponim, and also a facial expression was that of a young girl. Ufoshtu hakmotim. This intrigues me more than anything else. That the wrinkles that she had all disappeared. And they smooth out.
Wonderful.
Right. So she became like a young girl again. Okay? Batahar ho Yeshua batelet bein, right? The woman conceived and she gave birth to a son. So, first of all, the comment that Rashi already hinted at before, right? So, havas mi'abra beit losi yarchim yikora. Hey, she was already pregnant 3 months prior to, you know, giving birth, that is, to the remarriage, you know, to Amram, right? So, Amar Rabbi Yehuda bar Zvino. So Rabbi Yehuda bar Zvino says that this pasuk shows imakish leidosa leirasa. It says you can compare her birth to her pregnancy, namely ma horasa shelo betzar af leidosa shelo betzar. Even as when she was born without any pains whatever. In other words, presumably her mother had a very easy time of it, right? So, likewise, when she gave birth, shelo bitzar, right? She gave birth also without any pain. So, mikan, from this we learn, l'noshim sitkonios, that righteous women, shelo hoya befisko shalchava, that they were not in this statement that the Torah makes. Remember what Chava, you know, Eve, was to be punished, you know, for having
eaten
the tree of knowledge and so on and so forth. So if you remember what's written over there, it's written over there. Okay, let's take a look at Rashi again. Makish Leidoso, he says, Lo nechtav herayon ze elu nidroshkach. Why does it have to mention the fact that she was pregnant, he says, after all? As it says that she gave birth, we already can assume that she was pregnant beforehand. So therefore we have to assume that it's there to show something, namely that her pregnancy was not like, you know, was to show that being a righteous woman, she did not have to suffer the pisco shalchava. What is the pisco shalchava? Pisco normally means, you know, a little note or a decree in this case. In other words, the decree given to Chava, namely the gzar din, this is how Rashi explains it, right? Shalom. You know, with Chava's decree. Namely, Ushtar, well, he also says, you see, the word piska, normally we use it today, you know, for a note also, okay? So, it says another interpretation, and he gives Gezar Din, right, that this is a decree, and Shtar Gezeros, in other words, you know, the note literally for the decrees passed against Chava, which was what? Kilaloso de Isvan Hirayon. In other words, that she was cursed, or this Eve was cursed by the fact that she would have pain during her pregnancy. Of course, it means not only pain during your pregnancy, but also it means, of course, birth. Pain in giving birth as well. Right. Of course, the Torah says, Be'etzav Teildi Boni, right? In pain you will give birth to the children. So she, being a righteous woman, was spared that pain. Okay. Then the Torah continues. It says, Vatera Osoi Kitoifu, that she saw that he was good. Namely, she saw that, you know, the little baby, Moshe, okay, right, was good. Tanya. So we have a tradition. The Rabbi Meir Omer, Rabbi Meir says, Tov Shmo. He says that actually the name that she gave Moshe was not Moshe. As a matter of fact, who gave Moshe the name Moshe?
His daughter, his mother.
No.
No, the Pharaoh's...
Right, it was Pharaoh's daughter who called him Moshe. Pharaoh's daughter who gave the name Moshe.
Yeah.
Right. So the question is, so what was he called before he was called Moshe? You understand? I mean, Pharaoh's daughter said she called him Moshe because me namai mishisihu, right? I took him out of the water. Right. So, what, according to Rabbi Meir, his name was Tov.
Tov.
Tov. Okay. Why? Because the Torah says, Vatera Oso Kitopu, right? So she saw him that he was Tov. Okay? So according to Rabbi Meir, this shows that his name was Tov. Okay? Right.
Only one meaning for the word.
Right. This is Rabbi Meir. Okay. His name is Tov. Rabbi Yehuda Omer. Rabbi Yehuda says his name was Tov. Tovio. Right. Tovio Shmo. Name was, okay, you know, the good one, right? Because in the name Tovio, we already find, you know, that the idea that God is good.
Mm.
Because, you know, the latter part of the name means God,
yeah.
Okay? Okay.
Rabbi
Nechemia Omer, he says, Hogem Linevius. Okay. In other words, the fact that, you know, she saw that he was good means that she recognized in him the quality that he would be worthy to become a prophet, be, you know, worthy to give prophecy. Okay. Acherim omrim, there are those who say, others who say, nolad kishu bohu, he was born already circumcised. Okay. So that was, of course, a very extraordinary sign, you know, that he was an extraordinary child, right? And the sages say, at the time when Moshe Rabbeinu was born, okay, the entire house was filled with light. Here it's written, in other words, his mother saw that he was good, right, kitovum. And of course in another passage, obviously it's the story of Bereshis, right? What do we find over there? God saw that the light was good, and so therefore on this basis they make the drash that when he was born God was so good that, you know, the light itself came, because God was pleased that he was somebody who was going to teach Torah to the people of Israel. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Hogan and Vius, says Rashi, Ruach Baruch HaKodesh, says that Yocheved saw with the Ruach HaKodesh, you know, she had the Holy Spirit within her, she osid Leos Hogan Lidvua, that, you know, he would be someday worthy enough to prophesy. Okay. Then the Torah continues and says, "Vatitz penehu shlosha nirochim." All right, she hid him for how much?
3 months.
3 months. Okay. So the question is, how was she able to get away with it for 3 months after he was born? Right? How was she able to get away with the fact that the Egyptian police weren't there, you know, in order to take the baby?
And, she hid him.
Right. All right. So she hid him for 3 months. So the question is, the Leimonu Mitzrayim El Mishor Da Hadra says the Egyptians, you know, they took account as to when Amram and Yocheved remarried, And so they figured for 9 months after that.
That's
but
fine.
The fact, you see, that she was already pregnant 3 months before, that they didn't know. So that when he was born, she was still able to conceal him for 3 months. Okay? The Shosh of the Hadron, right? He has been brought. Beit was a young Meir Korah, right? And as we already said, you know, she was already pregnant 3 months before that time. All right. Then the pasuk says, "Velo yochlo oid hatzvino." Right? She was no longer able to conceal him. So the Gemara says, "Am I? Why? Tzitzpine v'seizel. Why couldn't she continue hiding him? Why couldn't she continue conceal him? She was able to get away with it 3 months. So why couldn't she have continued to get away with it? Right?" Elo was rather called Heicho the Havishami Mitzraya, you know, but whenever the Egyptians would hear the Misyale Yanuko, right, that a baby was born, so Mamtu Yanuko Hosam, then they would bring a baby there, Keheicho de Lishmaina Ma'abe. In order that, baby number one should be able to hear baby number two crying, because what happens if baby number two cries? Baby number one also gets the urge to cry. All right. Dichsiv, as the pasuk says in Shir Hashem, it says Echzulanu Shualim Shualim Ketanim, sees for us little foxes, who destroy the kingdom. Okay, it's the rest of the pasuk. We call them crowing over there. So they're applying this pasuk to the fact that they brought little foxes of their own, in other words, these little babies, in order to spy out the Jewish children. Then it's written, Batikach Lohei Teva Azkoba, right, that she took for him a little box of goma. Goma means like bulrushes, okay? So, says, Maishno Goma, why did she doubtful choose bulrushes? Why could she get something, as Rashi is going to say, sturdier, let's say, out of wood? You understand? So the answer is, right? Amar Rabbi Elazar, so Rabbi Elazar says, Mekan, from this we learn, Latzadikim, Shemamrenim Chaviv Aleim Yersim Ekufon, Bechol Kachloma, Lefi Shem Poshin Yideim Bebozim. Okay. It says, from this we learn that for righteous people, their money is precious unto them more than their bodies. Now, I don't want to misinterpret what it means. It doesn't mean, you know, that they sacrifice everything for
money.
A dollar. What it does mean, however, is it's based upon the next part of the sentence that we said. The kol chachlama, why so? The answer is, l'fi shein poshtin yideihim begozel. Because they're not going to engage in any sort of shady transaction, and, you know, stealing or anything, misappropriating and so on and so forth. So that therefore when we say that b'mayna b'chaviv aleihem, it means, in other words, that they do without luxuries because they don't have, you know, they don't want to involve themselves in anything which is in the least shady. And so therefore, this is why they don't have the money for luxuries. And so what does it mean? So it means that Yocheved, in turn, obviously didn't have the money, let's say,
to buy wood
in order to make this little box for Moshe. And so she took, you know, what was a lot cheaper, namely the bulrushes. All right, we'll see that from how Rashi understands it, okay? All right, we're up to right now the fifth line from the bottom in the Rashi over there. All right, we could go a line above with Vatispenehu, okay? Vatispenehu Shloshe Rochim, that she hid him for 3 months. So, it says Shloshe Chadoshim Yochlatz Pino. She was able to hide him for 3 months after she gave birth. Why? Because the Egyptians first came searching after 9 months had passed. Meshech Hazira, right, from the time that, you know, Amram had remarried her. plus a yarche may occur, but she was already pregnant for 3 months to begin with, you know, even before the time of the remarriage. And this is how we derive that chronology. Okay?
Yeah.
All right. Then the Gemara asked Amaitis B'nei V'Seisel, why couldn't she continue concealing him? She should continue. So he says, Be'acha, Shetzofim in the storm, since he was hidden away. So, in the storm, you're right, he was hidden away in a mysterious place, in a secret place, right? As the pasuk says that she hid him. So, my yesh lo lidog, then why should she worry? So the answer, of course, is that the Egyptians had a way of ferreting out Jewish children. Right? That the tzoek sham, he explains, ma'ave means tzoek, cry out, right? It's crying out there as the Egyptian child would cry. But there, kinok, litzok, is shishamea kol kinok haver, right? And it's normal for a child to weep, you know, to cry, if he hears another child crying. Okay. And then Echazulonu Shoalim says, Baskol Omer Lemei Hayom, right, says to the waters of the sea, Echazulonu Shoalim Haktanim Amchavlim Sankromim Biosam Smodar, right, Ba'ud HaPrikotan. In other words, seize for us the small foxes who destroy the vineyards while they are in blossom, while the fruit is still very young. And of course the idea, you know, the fruit being young means, you know, young children. Okay. And then Shechoviv Aleihem Amoinam, Rashi makes the statement, right, that their money is precious unto them. He says, Shedoma Buatim, they have very little money. The Afal Pi Shehoye Mishtamer Gufa Yosa Bishalaitzim Shekoshim Chazokim. And this, in spite of the fact that he himself, that is, that Moshe Rabbeinu, would have been better kept or guarded, you know, in a box made out of wood, which is, you know, hard and strong and wouldn't collapse so easily, right? So, but nevertheless, this shows, you know, that she didn't have the wherewithal, and so this is why she used it. However, we're also going to have another interpretation now, okay? Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani Omar, he says the reason is davar rach. She purposely wanted to have something which is a soft material, so to speak, right? Sheyochol la'noid b'fnei davar rach, b'fnei davar kosher. And this material could withstand something which is soft and something which is hard. In other words, the bulrushes, the nature of a bulrush is that it can't easily destroy it. So even though it is by its own nature soft, but nevertheless it also has the wherewithal to withstand. Okay? Rashi, 2 lines from the bottom, he says, Dovah Rach, he says, Bezeh, hu mishtamer yofeh bin akol. In other words, according to Rav Shul Baal Rachmeni, we see that with bulrushes, right, he would be preserved better than with any other material. Why? The fish are dovor hakosheh kishamayim olachinosel v'chosko hu niska. It says because with hard material, when the water carries it, you know, strongly, so it's going to bump against things. Okay? It's going to bump against things. And of course, if it bumps against things, right, the hu nishav v'nishpar, then it can be swept away and broken. Okay. Aval dovar kal, but something which is, you know, lightweight, soft, niskal and is darker, the evan lacharav. It's going to be simply bounce right off again and continue, right. Okay. So this is according to Rashi Shmuel Chameini why it was, you know, the rushes that she chose instead. Okay? This is also an interpretation that will come across. Right. Okay.
Okay.
Baruch Hashem. You got the idea. Okay. All right. Then it's written, Batosem bo es hayelet, right? She put the child there. Batos and Basuf. And she put him in where? Into the bulrushes, right? So Rabbi Elazar Omar, he says, Yamsuf. He says she put him into the Yamsuf, into the Red Sea. But Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani Omar, he says, no, it wasn't the Red Sea that she put him into. Huh? Pardon me? Did I? You're right. Thank you.
What'd you skip?
I skipped a line over here.
No.
Okay. Yeah. Matachma Vachivad's office, right? Of course. My eye just went to the wrong line. Okay. It's written, you know, that she smeared the bulrushes, right, with what? With
pitch.
Yeah, well, the first one is like clay slime, or slime. Slime is the English translation that they have over there, right? With slime and with pitch, okay? Or tar, whatever you want to call it, okay? So Tana, there's a tradition that says, Chemo b'mifnim, v'zefes b'mbachutz. In other words, she put the slime or the clay on the inside, right? And the tar, or the pitch, she put on the outside. Why? Okay, so that because this righteous person, this, in other words, Moshe Rabbeinu, should not have to smell the odor, the malodor, if you wish, of
slime,
you know, the, well, the slime is not odorous. It's the other one. It's the tar, the pitch, that, you know, that has a smell. Needless to say. Okay, so that's the reason why she did it. Okay. But, yeah, as Rashi says, the last, the Reach Ra, it says Shalzefus, right? Of the tar, you know, the pitch. And this is what has a Reach Ra. So, on the inside, she didn't want to make him have to smell that. All right. And then, where did she put it? So it says, Matos and Masuf. She put it in the Suf, right? So, according to Rabbi Elazar, he says, Emer Yamsuf. But she put him into the Yamsuf. But Rav Shmuel Bar Nachmani doesn't think that she put him into the Yamsuf. Omar, he says that she put him in where? Agam. Now, the only problem is, what is the meaning of the word Agam? The word occurs, of course, several places in the Bible, okay? And it has really two different interpretations, okay? One Agam is taken in the sense of like a pond, a pool of water, or something like that. This is how they translate, for example, right? That, you know, God turns the rock into a pool of water. That's how the English translation runs, okay? And therefore, you know, Agam today in modern Hebrew indicates a pond in normal usage today in modern Hebrew, okay? However, we can recognize in the word agam that it's related also to the word gomem that we had before, namely for the bulrushes, right? The material from which she put it. So in other words, agam could also indicate then bulrushes, okay? Let's say bulrushes because they translate simply rushes, okay? But you know, it's what grows at the banks of the ponds, rivers, and so on, okay? And Kedisiv, as the Pasuk says in Yeshayo, it says over there, Kone Vatsuf Komeil. In other words, reeds and rushes will wither away. All right. Rashi on the top, Agam Yisrael Shal Atzei Arova V'Kone Daki. All right? The Hu Kone Vatsuf says. The Atzei Arova, this of course would mean the willows, right? Because they grow also, you know, by the water. River, right, by water, right? The Kodim Dakim, and, you know, these are, thin reeds, right? Thin pieces of wood, so to speak. And it says, this is what they mean when it says Kone Vesuf in the Pasuk. Kone, says, is Konim, it's related to the word konim, in other words, rods, right? In Suf, he says, this is arova dafka. He says, Suf means like a thin willow. Okay? So, I don't know. I mean, this is how Rashi interprets it, okay? But, you know, I interpret the fact that Agam, in my opinion, I mean, because the word Agam obviously has a very close connection with the word Gomer.
Mm.
And therefore, the implication is in reeds. Okay. All right. Then it's written, Vatered bas Paro lirchos havayor. Right, that Pharaoh's daughter went down in order to bathe in the river. Okay. So the question is, why did she have to go to bathe in the river? Right? Maybe she could have found, you know, a bathtub in the royal palace. She didn't have to go, you know, to the river in order to bathe. But she went, that's right, she went for a very special reason. Says, Abba Rab Yochai, the Mishnah Rab Shimon ben Yochai, says, Melame, it teaches us, Sheyordo lirchotz migelulei avihar. She went down in order to bathe, in order to immerse herself from the idolatry of her father. In other words, what? As Rashi says on the top line there, lirchotz, he says, litbol sham, right, in order to immerse herself there, v'shem geirus, in order to become converted to Yiddishkeit.
Okay.
V'chein hu olner. Likewise, they have another pasuk that indicates, you know, that going in Tevlin in the mikveh or in the river. I mean, we know that, you know, a river can be used as a mikveh, right? In order to cleanse ourselves from tuma, right? Says. The pasuk says again in Yeshayahu, it says, "Imro chatzan Hashem es soas b'doy siyot." Right? Surely God will wash away the filth, if you wish, of the daughters of Zion. In other words, you know, the whatever they become contaminated with, so will be washed away. Then it's written, "V'naroseha holchos." Her maidens were walking naturally, you know, by the riverbank, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, Omer Rabbi Yochanan said, "Ein halicha zu ela l'shein misa." He says, you know why they were walking? Because they had murder in their mind. Because the word halicha has a connection with the word of misa. V'chein hu omer. And so it says, this is of course, you know what, Esav said to Yaakov, he says, Hinei anochi holech lamus, right? Behold, he says, I am going to die, right? So, holech lamus, you remember, you know, this is when, you know, Esau says, and therefore, v'loma zeli b'chera, so what do I need, you know, the birthright for? I'm going to die anyway, he says, so what do I need? So we see from this pasuk that there is a connection between the holech lamus and the fact that the maidens were also going, and they had killing on their mind. What do you mean killing on their mind? Well, it's written, Bateres Hateva B'Sechasuf, right? She saw the, you know, the little box with Moshe Rabbeinu in the midst of the rushes, right? So Kevin the Chazu, right? The Kobo Alatsud and the Moshe. So as soon as they saw, you know, that actually should be not Bo'u, probably should be Bo'a or Bo'a or something like that. But all right, at any rate, the idea is it's quite clear that when the maiden saw that she wanted to save Moshe Rabbeinu, Amru Lo, they said to her, Gevuraseinu, mistress, Min Hogei Shaloilam, the Welt Tirtzich, you know, in other words, this is the way the world is carried on, that what? Melech Mosav Adam Gerza Gezerah. A king who is a king of flesh and blood, right? He makes a decree. Im kol oylam kula imekai minosa. Now, let's say that not everybody will obey the decree, right? But nevertheless, bonov amnei beisom imekai minosa. Nevertheless, his children and the members of his household, they certainly have to obey the decree of the king. V'at overes al gezeres avich, and you are violating the decree that your father himself established. So Gabriel, the Malach came, the Chavot of the Karkach, and literally slammed them into the ground, right? In other words, they died. But, right? And so they died in order to what? So that, you know, that they shouldn't give us such bad aces, okay?
Right.
All right. Then it's written about Tishlach HaSamasa. So she sent her Amma, okay? Now, Amma means, of course, maidservant.
Yeah.
So obviously, there's already a psychical contradiction. Ma doch, right? If the maid, you know, the maidens who were going with her were all slammed into the ground and killed, so in that case, where does she have Amma? Where does she have a maidservant? So, therefore, there are two interpretations given right now. Okay. Interpretation number one. Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Chenya, there's a machlokes between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Chenya. Chad Omar, he says that the word Amosa means Yoda, her hand. Because, frankly, the word Amor is used in the sense of a cubit, if you remember. You know, it's a measure, an Amor, right?
Yeah,
Amor Mizen, so and so. You know, not a hand. That would be Tefah.
Oh, okay.
This is a Tefah, okay? Or according to what it's really. From here to there, okay. This would be the tefach. But what is the amma? Amma is from up to the elbow joint. And of course, exactly what that is, you know, there's a dispute as to whether it's 18 inches, 24 inches, you know, somewhere in that range between 18 and 24, okay. But nevertheless, the amma represents the forearm, okay. So, we see then that there is a difference of opinion. Right, Chad Omar Yoda, one says that Matishlach es Amosa means simply that she stretched forth her hand. In other words, the daughter of Pharaoh stretched forth her hand, right? The Chad Omar Shifchosa. And the other one says it was her maidservant. So, Mandoma Yoda, so according with the person who says that Amosa means her hand, yeah, that makes sense. Why? Dixiv Amosa. Right, because it's written she stretched forth her Oma. But Man de Oma Shifchoso, and how about the one who says that it was her Shifcho, you know, her maidservant? So he says, with the like Siv Yoda, right? After all, the Torah doesn't say Tishlach es Yoda, which would normally be the expression for, you know, to stretch forth your hand, right? But it was the word Amosa. So that therefore it wasn't her hand, but it was her maidservant, right? So, Amanda Omar Shifchoso. Alright, so, and the one who says that Amosa means a Shifcho, Ho Amrit Bogavir Vachaton, the Karka, right? Didn't you just say a minute ago that Gabriel came and he knocked the breath out of them, right? So, the answer is, in that particular case, if that's the opinion, the Shir Lo Chada. He says, well, Gabriel left her one maidservant yet. Why? The lav erach aro, lav urcho, excuse me, right, okay, usually.